From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 8 shootings, 6 murders, 2 states. The manhunt is on for a sniper terrorizing the Washington, D.C. area. In what could be the first lead in the case, the sniper left a taunting message for authorities outside the Bowie, Maryland school where a 13-year-old boy was shot Monday. Written on the back of a tarot card was the message, "Dear policeman, I am God." The investigation continues amid a media frenzy, police frustration, and stark public fear. In this hour, a serious look at criminal profiling and the challenges law enforcement officials face tracking down an invisible killer. We begin in Washington tonight with the latest developments in the investigation. James Jones is a reporter with WAMU in Washington and has been covering the sniper story. Earlier, I asked him if anyone in the Washington area has ever worked on a case like this before.
I don't think anyone could say they have, and I don't think there are too many people around the country who could even say they have. This is bizarre beyond belief. It's super, super frightening because the person seems to strike at random with incredible accuracy. You've got 8 people who have been hit, 6 died, 2 were wounded. They were all shot with one single shot to either the head or the chest. And it's about the scariest thing you could come up with, especially because this person seems to vanish without a trace. Well, not completely without a trace, but no one has really gotten a look at this person. No one has really seen a blast from the gun. It's like a lightning bolt. And you feel like almost anybody could be hit at any time. So that's why I think it's real tough on the people, and it's also tough on the police because they're dealing with something that they normally don't see at all. There's not a real pattern.
We saw the police looking flustered today as Montgomery County Police Chief Charles Moose begged the media not to dig into the evidence and said that he was afraid he didn't have control of his own team because someone had slipped out word of this tarot card. What is the latest that we know on the investigation and the police concerns?
Well, as far as the tarot card is concerned, that has been confirmed by the police as something that they did find, and it is the very first solid clue outside of ballistics evidence that we heard about. Now, that's really, I'm overstating the point there because the police have collected a lot of evidence. But the bottom line is we still don't have any strong leads. As far as the tarot card story, one television station down here reported it first, and everybody else picked up on it, and Charles Moose, he got very, very upset about the whole thing. It's kind of rough because it was one of his guys who gave up the story, and early on in this, he was trying to use the media as well as he could to help in the investigation. This morning, the only way to describe it is he snapped. If you heard it, I heard the press conference this morning, he was absolutely raging angry about this. He was angry at the media. He was angry at his police force for talking. I don't think you're going to get too many more leaks of that nature in this particular investigation. Now, when you talk about leads or talk about how the case is moving forward, the latest shooting of the 13-year-old kid just before he went into school, he was shot, did yield quite a bit more evidence than some of the others. They knew where the shot came from. They were able to recover a bullet casing. They were able to get ballistics evidence that linked it with the other ones. But more than that, they were able to pick up some stuff at the site, which they haven't been able to do in the others.
Have you heard any analysis of this card and its strange cryptic message, "Dear policeman, I am God"? Are people making much of this? Is this a window into the mentality at work here?
Well, we have a complete blackout on the tarot card now because nobody really wants to talk about it in terms of what it means. It was the death card of the tarot deck. The person who used that may have been an expert with the tarot card, may not have been an expert. Nobody knows. Obviously, the message was quite chilling, regardless of what the card said. It probably will fit into somebody's psychological profile. Some of these people that are doing profiling could probably be able to make something from the card. They also may even be able to determine where the card could have been purchased, and also determine whether there are a group of people around here in the D.C. area that are into the tarot card thing. It's really difficult because of the fact that this person could have tarot cards and never come into contact with anybody else who's using a tarot card. So it's a pretty difficult piece of evidence, but it is chilling.
James, give us a sense of how people are going about their lives in the shooting area. What's the level of fear, of frustration? Are people changing their daily habits? How is it seeping into the daily interaction and activity of people?
People were very upset early on when these random killings were taking place, particularly because the people were involved in just everyday activities. But once the kid was shot, it was a whole different thing. The fear was accompanied by anger, and now parents are, as you could imagine, taking a lot of precautions, and many more taking their kids to school. But as far as the person on the street, everybody still got to live our lives here. And I think, you know, 9/11 had a lot to do with the folks having this attitude of let's just keep going on. Are people looking over their shoulder? Oh, yeah, you better believe they are, especially in the areas where this occurred. But I don't think you could say that the region is paralyzed or anything like that.
And what's the volume of tips or leads coming into the police? Do we have any idea at this point?
They are checking out, I believe the number was 2,500, what they would consider credible leads just in Montgomery County. At the end of the day yesterday in Prince George's County, they were approaching the 1,000 mark. Now, as these attacks happen, more and more people call. And, you know, we hope there isn't another attack. But with the latest attack, there were more tips given in the first couple of hours of this one than, you know, almost all of the tips combined before. So they're getting a lot of help from the public. But at the same time, they have to go through all of this and sort out, you know, the stuff that means something from the stuff that means nothing. Today, for instance, there was a report of a person carrying a black bag that could have been a gun case. And everybody rushed to the scene and checked it out. And they didn't find anyone. And they discovered that people had been surveying in the area. So these tips are going to really help the police. They're not telling us about the really good ones. Nobody believes the police is telling the public everything that they know. That would not be smart, and everybody knows that. So when you talk about the investigation and where it stands, it's really difficult to know because we don't know how much the police really know.
And there is a very public amount of reward money on offer, and it keeps growing. Where does that reward stand now? Who's putting up the money?
I didn't see the latest figure, but it was about, last I saw, about $250,000. I think it was, I believe, $267,000 was the last number I heard. It's coming in from a lot of sources. First, Montgomery County started with $50,000, and then the state of Maryland came in with $100,000. Since then, there was one businessman who matched Montgomery County with another $50,000, and that makes up the bulk of it. But since then, individual citizens, people from all around the country, have been just sending checks and saying, hey, this should go into the reward.
And what about the resources for the investigation? Beyond Montgomery County, what kind of support do they have? Is it sufficient?
Well, I would say we've got every single piece of law enforcement in the whole area involved in this, because Prince George's County, where the young the boy was shot, they jumped into the investigation. And, of course, we have the resources of the federal government here. Montgomery County has asked the Justice Department to get involved. The FBI has been involved since Thursday of last week after there were those series of shootings all in a row. The alcohol, tobacco, and firearms people, the Federal Bureau, is engaged in all of this activity. So I'd say there are no resources out there that are not being put into this, especially the fact that it's in the nation's capital. That does also provide a lot of resources that your average run-of-the-mill local police department wouldn't have.
James Jones, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
James Jones is a reporter with WAMU. He spoke with us from Washington. With everyone around Washington feeling like a target, how much does the public deserve to know about the sniper on the loose? What produces this kind of killer? And what catches this kind of killer? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Buffalo, New York is Dr. Charles Ewing, a forensic psychologist at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Ewing.
Thank you.
Charles Ewing, as you sit back, you hear these details coming out like all of us do. It's a chilling story. It's clearly a deadly and already tragic story, utterly mysterious to a civilian ear. You're a forensic psychologist. How does a forensic psychologist begin to sift through these tidbits and mysteries to think about this case?
Well, ordinarily, in trying to profile a case like this, we would look first at the victims and then at the forensic evidence, the crime scene evidence. And part of the reason this case is so baffling and so difficult to even profile or even begin to profile is because we don't have those connections that we normally have. With a serial killer, normally we have the victimology. We understand who the victims are, and we have some idea of why they were selected.
You mean the rationale that a serial killer might have?
Yes. And it's in many cases, if not most cases, there's some kind of sexual motivation. In this case, we have no clue as to what the perpetrator's motives are. And also, we don't really have any physical evidence to speak of. There are the bullet fragments, and now I understand there's a spent shell, and now we have possibly this tarot card. But other than that, there's not much to work with. So where we begin is what we know statistically about people who are likely to commit this kind of crime. But even there, we're somewhat hamstrung because this is almost a unique crime. This is not the ordinary serial killer who goes about killing people over a period of time. And this is not the person who comes into, let's say, McDonald's or some other setting and commits a mass murder.
So, Charles Ewing, how would you characterize this sniper?
Well, I think, first of all, anything that I say is obviously speculation.
Absolutely. I mean as a category, not the particular man or woman.
Yeah. Well, I would characterize him as a spree killer. This is someone who is acting with a plan and with a purpose. We don't know what the purpose is, but clearly these killings have been well planned. I've heard them characterized in the media as random, and I think that's absolutely wrong. The victims have been chosen at random, but the killings have not been random.
Now, what do you mean exactly by that?
Well, it's clear to me as I look at the map and the time frame with regard to these killings and the manner in which they were committed, that this perpetrator is selecting his locations in advance and moving to those locations systematically and then looking for the first available human target.
Do you see a perceptible rationale in the locations, the choice of location?
Yes. I mean, he has selected locations where he can get in and out very quickly. So far, he's been able to take, I believe, 8 or 9 shots. He shot at 8 people and shot at a store window, and not a single witness has come forward and said, I saw him or I saw anything of him. There have been scattered reports early on of maybe a van, but they don't seem to have materialized. It seems to me that this is a person who has picked his sites rather than his targets.
As a forensic psychologist, this morning when the news came out of this tarot card with this kind of melodramatic message on it, did that take your perceptions about this killer into a different zone?
No, I think it kept them pretty much where they were. Somebody who's intelligent, manipulative, narcissistic. I see the use of this tarot card as an effort to manipulate both the police and the media. And unfortunately, it appears that he's done a really good job of that because he's been able to keep control of the way people are viewing this case by doing that.
Does it tell you something about motivation? You said in most serial killing cases, there's a sexual motivation that does not seem to be readily apparent here. How would you track the motivation?
Well, it's difficult to track because you have a killer here who's not making any physical contact with his victims. He's scrupulously avoiding that. He's apparently picking them not on any particular individual basis. What it says to me is this is a person who is gratified not by the kill itself, but by what surrounds the kill and the terror that it brings. I don't mean this in the sense that we've all come to think of it since 9/11, but mm-hmm. I do think this is a terrorist and that this person views himself as a terrorist, someone who is taking great pleasure and enjoyment in terrorizing the community.
Possibly even inspired environmentally by 9/11?
It's conceivable. When I look at inspiration for killing, I'm always looking for some kind of trigger mechanism, something that turned this person from an everyday, perhaps disturbed, but generally functioning individual into a killer.
Charles Ewing, hold that thought. We're going to come back and talk about the trigger. We're talking about tracking a killer tonight, about the psychology and law enforcement and the D.C. sniper on the run, on the loose. What kind of man or woman would do this? With a long-distance rifle, no fingerprints, do police have a prayer? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about tracking a killer, about psychology, law enforcement, and the D.C. sniper. What kind of man or woman would do this? And is this crime or terrorism? Is there a difference in this case? And how can the media report this story without wrecking the investigation? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Dr. Charles Ewing. He's a forensic psychologist at the State University of New York at Buffalo. And Dr. Ewing, I want to ask you, we're talking about what would trigger this kind of activity. And before you describe that, I hope you'll give us one more facet on this, which is something that is obvious and everyone's noted. It's the marksmanship here. I mean, it's terrifying. And it's kind of the ultimate identifier here. We've got a long-range rifle, maybe effective up to 700 yards, we read. How significant is it that you have a killer with that kind of talent? What does that tell you about who or what kind of person this might be?
Well, it could tell us a lot of things. It certainly tells us that somebody is very familiar with guns and is a skilled marksman. But where he developed that talent, we don't know. It's conceivable that it was military. It's conceivable that it was through hunting or some other community organizations or activities over the years. It's really difficult to say. Or whether this was developed purposely to carry out these attacks.
Does the methodical kind of execution of the crimes lead you to lean toward military or that kind of training or not?
Yeah, I would say yes, but I'd have to caution that that's really a speculation. I don't think there's really any evidence of that at this point, but certainly the nature of the killing would lead one to speculate that, sure.
And the trigger for this, maybe it's been methodically planned for a long time. Maybe there was a talent there or training already in place. As a forensic psychologist, you must think a lot about, beyond motivations to trigger, what gets a person to get started, to stand up and begin something as horrible as this.
Well, I expect that there's some major loss in this person's life, major failure, something that triggered this, whether it's a loss of employment, a loss of family, divorce, loss of custody of children, but all that speculation. But I guess my point is simply that people don't wake up one morning and simply decide to go out and commit crimes like this without something happening in their lives that is a turning point, a turning event. It's possible that this is somebody who was drummed out of the military. It's possible that somebody lost his job. It's possible someone who's undergoing some kind of traumatic relationship experience. Clearly, this person has an agenda and has, in his own mind, a belief that he's doing something that's worthwhile, whether it's exacting revenge for some perceived slight or harm that's been done to him, or some delusional belief. There's certainly a belief there that he's doing the right thing.
The right thing that is so clearly the wrong thing and tragic already for so many families.
Certainly.
Charles Ewing, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Captain Robert Snow. He's joining us from Indianapolis. He's commander of the homicide branch for the Indianapolis Police Department. He's author of several books, including SWAT Team, Explosive Face-Offs with America's Deadliest Criminals. Good evening and welcome, Captain Robert Snow.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for being on with us tonight. Robert Snow, as you look at the challenge that law enforcement officials around Washington, D.C. are facing in the last week and tonight, how does a law enforcement person like yourself begin to think about tackling a crime so elusive with a killer so invisible?
Well, this case has a number of difficulties. Is that, number one, it's a high-profile case, and so there's a lot of pressure to get it solved.
Does that help or hurt?
That hurts more than anything because homicide investigation is very detailed, and it takes a lot of time occasionally. But in this case, you don't have a lot of time. You've got to stop this man before he strikes again.
But that's not – is that a matter of media pressure or just the drumbeat of killings?
Well, the drumbeat of killings, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Well, media pressure too, but my goodness, you can't wait till this person kills again.
Yes.
So there's a lot of pressure to immediately
– Six dead in a week, the pressure could hardly be larger.
No, I don't think so. I feel for the people there. Yes, I would hate to have a case like this in Indianapolis.
So how does that shape the investigation?
Well, you have to throw a lot of people into the investigation. Usually, most homicides, you have one or two detectives handling it. Here, I understand they probably have hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way to solve this case is through information. Someone knows something, And what you have to do is you have to put detectives out, policemen out, and talk to people. Because you often find that people know things, but they aren't going to tell you, the police, unless the police come to them first. Because, number one, they don't want to be known as a snitch. And so the police usually have to canvass the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. This way, if you're talking to everybody in the neighborhood, people don't mind talking to you because it doesn't look like they're a snitch.
But there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people living in this area. Who do you begin to even talk to?
I think if it was me, I see on the TV yesterday where they were doing the geographic profiling.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would concentrate my detectives in the area where they think this person is from to start with and then branch out.
But how can they even know that? There's Montgomery County, there's Washington, D.C. proper, there's Fredericksburg, Virginia, 80 miles to the south. How do you begin to know geographically, all drawing circles, looking at the radius intersections?
Yes. And I was watching the gentleman on TV talk last day about the geographic profiling and how they can narrow it down to a square mile or so. And that would be manageable. With enough detectives, that would be manageable.
But the
good thing about these sort of things is people like this are seldom silent. They've told someone, they've talked to someone. Someone knows what this person is going to do. And you have to find, but the problem is you have to find that person and make sure that person tells you what happened.
What's your assessment of this killer from what you've seen, admittedly, from afar? What do your instincts tell you?
Well, there are several possibilities. This person could simply be picking people at random. Yes, he could. In which case, that makes it a very difficult case because in homicide, the first thing you look for is who would want this person dead and who would profit from it.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you pick them randomly, you lose that. The second possibility that the police, I'm sure they've already considered, is maybe not. This is not random. Maybe there is one person in this bunch that the person wanted to kill, and you just simply kill the rest of them as camouflage.
And the rest is window dressing.
Also,
there's the mind of a homicide detective at work. I wouldn't have thought of that. Robert Snow, Charles Ewing, stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. It's something that's very much on people's minds, and I want to invite them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Scott's calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Well, thanks.
An interesting thought about this is, I tend to disagree just a little bit about what the captain said, and that's that, you know, maybe what we need to look at is the pattern. If you guys remember a number of decades ago with the Zodiac killer, who was actually, I don't believe, ever apprehended, and the only way they figured it out was, of course, some leavings and some specific things that the killer left, but there was a pattern, a specific pattern to what
he was
doing.
Do you mean a geographic pattern or choice of targets?
I don't know. I think it's too early to tell, but maybe it's tied to geographics. I just think that we're probably dealing with somebody that does have a motive, but it's just a matter of time before we try to figure out what the pattern is.
Scott, let me put that to Charles Ewing. When you think in terms of patterns, I guess you can take that into all kinds of realms. There's a geographic realm that Captain Snow mentioned. Are there psychological patterns or templates that might be helpful here?
Well, the thing that jumps out at me, and it's not necessarily psychological, although it may have psychological implications, is the timing pattern, the time of day at which these offenses were committed, where they were committed, and the rapidity with which they were committed. That's the pattern that I see. I mean, beyond the obvious pattern that they were committed with the same weapon and they were committed in the same manner. But I don't see a pattern here ordinarily, and I believe that the detective could address this better than I can. But ordinarily, you see patterns, and there just isn't much of a pattern here yet. A pattern may emerge. I hope it does.
Captain Robert Snow, other patterns beyond geographic, really anything to grab onto?
Well, as the professor said, I would look for a time of day. In other words, is this person doing it on lunch hour? Is this person doing it when they get off work, before they go to work, what have you? And you have to, again, you have to look for any kind of pattern you can find, anything that can direct you toward the killer.
It doesn't sound like much to work with. Chris is calling from Boston. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
I
had a question, and this relates directly to pattern. Perhaps since we don't seem to have a pattern, have you looked at other potential motivations? One thing that comes to mind is maybe we have somebody from the extreme right, perhaps somebody who's lost someone in 9/11, who might be motivated because they sense an easing or a lack of pursuit towards our enemies in that person's mind.
So some kind of twisted political agenda here, Chris.
Exactly, and maybe we are talking about someone from a military background Perhaps since you don't have a pattern in terms of the victims, you need to look at people who might fit a profile in terms of that type of motive.
Well, that's interesting. Charles Ewing, I guess that brings us to you again. If you are there base templates that you would go to in thinking about a killer like this? I guess starting with gender, with, I don't know, a childhood experience of some kind that's identifiable, of affiliations of any kind. Are there basic building blocks that would go right up to political orientation that you would take into account or not?
Well, the two most obvious basic building blocks are gender and age. This is a young man. This is a male who's in his 20s or 30s would be my estimation, and likely to be a white male.
Why do you say that?
Well, because that's what statistics tell us.
About serial killers?
Yeah, about serial killers. The problem with extrapolating from those statistics to this is that this case is so different. But based on what we know, and again, this is not a science, it's an art, but based on what we know, those three characteristics would jump right out at you. In addition, I agree with the caller that this is a person who has lost something and has experienced some kind of traumatic loss, and that's what triggered this. And it could be related to 9/11. It could be related to some political beliefs. I don't know anything at this point that would point to any particular pattern of political beliefs other than the fact that this is happening in and around our nation's capital.
And put it in a little bit of a historical context for us. Is this a new kind or amplitude of spree killer, as you described the killer earlier? Are we witnessing a new phenomena here, or is this something that just pops up every now and then across the years?
Well, it does pop up every now and then. The earliest case I'm aware of goes back to 1958 or 59. Charles Starkweather and his girlfriend went on sort of a terror rampage in, I believe it was in Nebraska and several other plain states. And over the years, there have been, maybe three or four other cases like this. You may recall the Andrew Canaan case back in 97, where he's the gentleman who killed Johnny Versace.
Mm-hmm.
And then moved around the country and committed in very rapid succession several homicides. But there aren't many of these kinds of cases, at least that I'm aware of, and I've made it my business to try to be aware of them.
And there's something different here from the rifle man who climbs the bell tower and in one hour or two of shooting picks off a lot of people. There's something disturbingly more methodical about this.
Well, that's the mass murderer, and most mass murderers, in my estimation, have a suicidal bent because they're going into the situation realizing that, yes, they will kill a number of people and they'll satisfy some homicidal urge, but they're likely to be killed themselves. This particular perpetrator, I believe, doesn't believe he's going to be caught, doesn't want to be caught, is not acting out of some kind of suicidal motive.
Wow, the idea that you could do this and get away with it. Peter's on the line. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just listening. I tuned in late. And the question I had is, when he gave out the clue today with the tarot card, said, I'm playing God, is he actually starting to act in a playful way? Is this a game that he is playing, that where he wants to drop various clues because, God forbid, he's enjoying this thing and he's enjoying the publicity and he wants to puzzle everyone? Or is it a way for him to eventually get caught? But he's signaling in one way or another, and it's either because of playfulness, if you can call it that.
Or a desire even to be caught. Peter, it's a good question. Captain Robert Snow, what about that? I mean, we went from radio silence from this killer to suddenly this dramatic, this melodramatic tarot card, the death card, the message, dear policeman, I am God. What does that tell you? Is this playfulness? Is this first evidence of a desire to actually be caught?
Well, first off, you have to consider whether he dropped it there. Keep in mind, this event is getting a lot of press coverage, and so you'll get a lot of people who want to get involved in this. And I don't think the police know yet if he actually dropped it or a prankster dropped it.
So it could be somebody else tromping around 150 yards from the school entrance.
Anytime you get a major event like this, people mm-hmm. want to join in, and you always have copycat things like that. That's what really scares me, is that this is going to spawn copycat events around the country.
And then you don't know what's going on.
Yeah, we have to remember Mr. Cooper when he hijacked a plane. Mm-hmm. No one had ever done it before then. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, what happened? We had thousands of these. Well, that's what worries me about this case, is quite often people don't think about doing these sort of things till they see all the gigantic media this person gets. And to some people's minds, this person looks like a hero. I mean, this person looks like he's bigger in life. And then you think, my God, I could be that way too.
So we take your point. It could be even a school kid who dropped the card
Absolutely.
There, who rolled around on the grass. But let's imagine for a moment that it's not.
Yes.
What does that tell you? There's a message here. Our caller calls it playfulness. It's a very bizarre kind of playfulness. But how would you interpret it as a homicide detective?
I would interpret it as a very valuable piece of evidence, extremely valuable piece of evidence, if I thought that was the person who left it, because there's all kind of evidence you can leave on notes like that that most people aren't aware of
mm-hmm.
that the police will be able to find. Yes, I would treat this, first off, you wouldn't know if it was or not, but regardless, you would treat it as an extremely valuable piece of information. Mm-hmm. You have handwriting, you have DNA, you have fingerprints, you have where the tarot cards come from, various things you can check out. I mean, this person is giving you a tremendous lead, and you wonder why.
And you saw today Police Chief in Montgomery County, Charles Moose, just enraged yes. about the fact that this card had been released to the press by someone in his outfit, yes. obviously. Why so much rage and anger? What was lost in revealing that to the public?
Because you never, never tell the public everything about a major case, because in a case like this, you'll have people want to come and confess to you who didn't really do it, but only want to confess because the media coverage. You want to have something that only they would know, so you can separate these people. Because you'll probably get a dozen people want to come and tell you, I did it, I'm the one that did it, only because they want the media coverage, they want the attention.
And then you spend time and manpower,
yes,
woman
right.
power sorting that out.
Exactly. So you want something this person can tell you, and if this person tells you, I'm the person there, I dropped a tarot card, and nobody knows this but the police, now you're very interested in this person. And I can understand the police just anger, because the media can be your friend or not so much your friend, depending on how they use it, how much information they get, and how they use it. But you got to keep in mind, the media has a job to do, and so do you. And it's your job, if you don't want them to have the information, to keep it away from them. Obviously, someone in his organization didn't do that, and I can understand his anger. But, again, the news media is simply doing their job. The information came to them, and they have to report it.
Well, it's quite a job. We're talking tonight about tracking a killer, about psychology, law enforcement, and the Washington, D.C. area sniper. My guests tonight are Dr. Charles Ewing, a forensic psychologist at the State University of New York at Buffalo, and Captain Robert Snow, commander of the homicide branch for the Indianapolis Police Department. You can join this conversation as well. What kind of a man or woman would do this? What could make this kind of killing attractive to a killer? And if this were happening in your neighborhood, would you want schools closed, offices shuttered, or business as usual? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is S2345.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about tracking a killer in the area of the nation's capital, about psychology, about law enforcement, and the D.C. sniper. My guests tonight are Dr. Charles Ewing, forensic psychologist at the State University of New York at Buffalo, and Captain Robert Snow, commander of the homicide branch for the Indianapolis Police Department. You're welcome to join us as well. When everyone feels like a target, how much does the public deserve to know? How has America bred this kind of criminal? And how would you bring in this killer? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom.
Good evening.
It's obvious to me, anyway, that this could possibly be an Al-Qaeda terrorist attack. If I were going to terrorize Washington, D.C., I can't imagine of a better way to do it other than crash a plane into the Pentagon.
But what makes
it quite easy for them to do it?
But
is this being considered?
Well, perhaps it is, but I want to ask you first, John, what makes it obvious to you? I mean, there have been plenty of American serial killers, even American terrorists. Why do you see Al-Qaeda here? Just because of 9/11?
Negative, because Al-Qaeda's been telling us they're going to continue to attack, and nation's capital has been a target for him in the past, and
mm-hmm.
they indiscriminately hit civilians, and that's what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
It all fits to to my way of thinking, not that it makes it the only solution, but I've not heard anybody even discuss the possibility.
Well, it's a question and an observation that must have flitted around in the back of the minds of many people, John, and thanks for your call and question. Robert Snow, how about it? This is clearly terrorizing a community. Is this a terrorist? Is it worth thinking about this being an Al-Qaeda terrorist?
Well, of course, as in police investigation, you have to consider all options. My only problem with that thought is that they would let you know. There's no point in doing a terrorist activity if you don't let everybody know who did it. That's the point of terrorism. They want you to know what they've done, what they can still do.
But would they let you know so soon? I mean, maybe they'd want to put, half a dozen killings under their belt before they began to leak that.
I think if I was Al-Qaeda, I'd let you know by now, because people are terrorized, and that's the point. And I'd let you know that there are going to be more of them, and that would really terrorize people. And I mean, again, as a police detective, mm-hmm. you wouldn't discount anything. No, you wouldn't say, no, that's impossible, because nothing's impossible.
But if it were coming from that corner, you'd expect some kind of sign, Charles?
I would expect some kind of, yes, mm-hmm. see, we told you so type thing. Mm-hmm. And to let you know where this is coming from.
Right.
And so, and again, the idea of a terrorist is instill terror, but they want you to know where it come from. I mean, there was no mistake when the planes hit New York City. Where's this all coming from?
It came out pretty quickly, didn't it?
That's the point of terrorism. You want people to know who's doing it and what's going to happen if you don't, give it to their demands.
Mm-hmm. Though, Charles Ewing, from a psychological point of view, there is clearly the tremor of terror that hit Washington last year with the Pentagon fiasco and with the anthrax threat. The nation's capital is effectively tingling in a bad way again here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've talked to several reporters today, and one reporter said that people are talking about this as some kind of diversionary tactic in preparation for some bigger attack. I mean, that's the level, the almost panic level that some people have reached in this.
Mm-hmm. And we heard from a friend of ours here today who had flown into Washington that he found himself sliding down in the taxicab seat, not wanting his head to be above the door. I mean, it gets into people's minds.
It certainly does, and that's what I think is fueling this perpetrator. And I think that I agree with Captain Snow about the release of that tarot card, even if it is related to the investigation, perhaps especially if it's related,
mm-hmm.
it not only fuels the public terror, but it's really playing right into the hands of this perpetrator to release it and to say to the world, this is what he's done.
And to play to his drama, to kind of dance to his tune.
Exactly.
Kevin is on the line. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Well, thanks.
I have a question. Being someone who's hunted and had a lot of experience with high-powered rifles,
yes.
With the caliber, such as AR-15s, 264s, and things like that,
uh-huh.
there's a tremendous amount of noise that's generated when you fire off one of these rounds.
And noise you can hear from a long way off.
Not only that, but also in a close proximity. I mean, and they said nothing about these bullets being silenced, how it's muffled. I know for a fact that I couldn't take a AR-15, go downtown Boston or somewhere, fire off a round without everybody within 20 feet of me knowing that I had done something like that. It's a distinct sound. It's not something that's easily ignored.
So how is this killer getting away with firing a loud shot like that without making a noise?
Absolutely, especially in a environment where he has to have a direct line of sight. The farthest that he could probably make this shot is something like 1,000 yards without running into an obstruction in the city or something like that.
And these are fairly densely populated areas. Kevin, it's a great question. Robert Snow, how about it? Can you put a silencer on a rifle of this high power? Would the ballistic test tell whether or not it had been silenced? How do you deal with the thunderclap of the rifle shot?
I think first you probably select your location from where you fire from very well, very carefully, so that you're not surrounded by anyone who could hear you if at all possible.
But how dense would the woods have to be, or how thickly muffled the apartment you've got a window in?
It depends on how far away you are from people. And by the way, you know that making a silencer is not really that difficult. If you can pick it off the internet. There's a number of websites, and they'll tell you how to make a silencer.
Even for a super high powered rifle.
Yes.
And what about, I guess that goes to the noise question, though. You still wonder where someone, if they've got a silencer or someplace very private to shoot from, and that's changing all the time. What about the marksmanship itself? How rare is this caliber of marksmanship?
it's not actually it's not as spectacular as people think, simply because keep in mind this person is setting themselves up, being very prepared. Their target has no idea what's going on. The only time your aim really gets messed up is mine shooting back at you. Having been in a couple of gunfights, I know your aim really goes bad when people shoot at you. But when you're completely safe yourself, set up, and you have this scope on your rifle, and you're waiting, and this person, that spec thing, it's not as hard as you think. The person could have had training at being a hunter, or it could have been, you know, a young boy, his dad taught him how to shoot.
But the targets in this case are completely unsuspecting.
Exactly.
So,
standing around. They're not dodging, jumping, or hiding if you're in a gun battle.
Let's get
they're
one
not
more,
shooting back at you.
Let's get one more call. Pauline's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Pauline. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment question is the fact that the victims are not similar, I think speaks to something, too. I mean, it tells us, I would think it would tell us what the perpetrator is not. I'm not sure what all of the victims are, male, female.
Give us, for example, what you think they might
for
not
example,
be.
For example, if there's, if some of the victims are black, some are white, it's probably not racial. If some are young, some are old, some are male, some are female.
Mm-hmm.
Just the randomness of it in itself, I would think, would say something.
Well, let's see if we have any idea what. Charles Ewing, how about that? We have victims here from age 13 to 72,
right.
clearly all ages vulnerable. Any pattern, or does the randomness itself reveal something significant?
Well, it reveals that this killer doesn't care who he kills. He's not concerned about the victims or who they are. His motivation has nothing to do with any particular victims or any gratification that he gets out of killing any particular person. I think his gratification lies elsewhere, and that's why it's such a puzzling case to solve.
Captain Robert Snow, we've just got a few seconds left. What's it going to take to crack this case and end this nightmare for the Washington area?
Probably a lot of luck. A lot of police cases are solved by good luck, of happening to stumble onto something, or meeting the one person who has information that's important that'll solve this case.
$250,000 reward, will that make a difference?
Yes, it will. But the most important thing is it's going to take a lot of hard work. Homicide is a very detailed, difficult job. It takes lots and lots of footwork and lots of talking to people.
Well, it sounds like there are a lot of feet on the street tonight. Captain Robert Snow, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Captain Robert Snow is commander of the homicide branch of the Indianapolis Police Department and author of SWAT Team, Explosive Face-Offs with America's Deadliest Criminals. And Dr. Charles Ewing, thank you for being with us tonight from Buffalo.
You're welcome.
Dr. Charles Ewing is forensic psychologist at the State University of New York at Buffalo. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a Maryland woman talks about the fear that's gripped her community. This is On Point. This week has seen anything but life as usual for communities in the Washington, D.C. area. Many public schools have canceled outdoor recess indefinitely. Businesses are reporting significant drops in sales as many residents adhere to a self-imposed curfew. In this radio diary, Baltimore Sun columnist Susan Reimer says not even the September 11th attacks have left her as scared as this week's sniper attacks.
When a truck bomb blew the facade off the federal building in Oklahoma City and killed 168 people, I wasn't afraid. I was shocked that an American could strike against his own in such a murderous way, but I wasn't worried. It was the work of a loner, and they caught him almost immediately. Even if Timothy McVeigh were part of a homegrown anti-government cell, I was not part of the hated federal government, and I didn't feel vulnerable. When terrorists flew airplanes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, I wasn't afraid. I was stunned by such an attack within our borders and convinced that there would now be no limit to the grisly imagination of terrorists. But I can't say that I felt afraid. I don't work in a building that is a symbol of American financial or military power. And although Disney World and the Super Bowl might also be symbolic targets, I wasn't planning on being in either of those places. I reassured my children and myself that terrorists weren't likely to make a political statement by blowing up their suburban high school or the local mall. Even when anthrax dust began to show up in the mail, I wasn't afraid. But this time, it's different. This time, I am afraid. Somebody with a high-powered rifle is picking off everyday people doing everyday things. Six are dead, and two more are wounded. They were vacuuming out a van, pumping gas, walking into school, sitting on a bench, buying groceries, cutting the grass. They were not walking home alone after the bars closed. They were not hanging out on a drug corner. They were not reporting to work for the military-industrial complex. What's more, this isn't happening in Los Angeles or Houston or Portland, Maine. It's happening very, very close to home. The sniper chose a 13-year-old walking to the door of his middle school in Bowie, Maryland, a community so close to mine that I shop there. Suddenly, geographic profiling doesn't sound like voodoo police work to me. I want to get a look at that map. Just how close is he getting to my neighborhood, I want to know. My gas station, my dry cleaners, my children's school. More than any time in the recent history of convulsive violence in this country, I feel like I or someone I love or someone I know well could be next. Montgomery County Police Chief Charles Moose, tearful and angry, said, "This is getting to be really, really personal now." He was talking, I think, about the fact that the killer was defying the best efforts of the police and going after children, but this is really, really personal for another reason as well. I am personally very afraid, and I cannot buck myself up with renewed determination to go about my daily routines and show this outlaw that Americans cannot be cowed, because doing daily routines is exactly how people are dying this time. You could argue that September 11th was a routine day for the unsuspecting victims in the World Trade Center, but a pair of 110-story towers at America's Financial Nerve Center that had been a terrorist target once before is hardly the strategic equivalent of a bus stop in Silver Spring, Maryland. I imagine that Osama bin Laden wanted to make a huge statement in addition to killing the maximum number of innocents, and that is why he chose the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But if he really wanted to stop America in its tracks, he might have just sent 20 snipers to this country instead of 20 hijackers. All of us will have to fight, Prince George's County Police Chief Gerald Wilson said. We cannot allow one individual to shut down that spirit in us. But that is exactly what is happening. Parents are keeping children home from school, and schools are keeping the rest of the children indoors. Community and sporting events are being canceled. Adults have been seen bobbing and weaving from the car to the grocery store. Dry cleaners and gas stations are reporting reduced foot traffic. Doors are locked and shades are drawn. It seems as if this sniper knows something Al-Qaeda did not. Gun down enough women loading groceries into vans, enough men filling their gas tanks, enough children walking to school, enough joggers, enough babies in strollers in enough anonymous neighborhoods, and you will make even the hardiest Americans feel afraid and vulnerable.
Susan Reimer is a columnist with the Baltimore Sun. She lives in Annapolis, Maryland. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.